The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Parade Magazine and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Well, we'll soon be celebrating Halloween, so what better time to visit some ghostly destinations on Armchair Traveler? And our first stop is none other than Hollywood. Yep, writer Chris Gill will lead our tour in his article Haunted Hollywood, published in the October 7th, 2018 issue of Parade Magazine. And he kind of caps it with this little picture of the Hollywood sign that's so famous. Oh, Hollywood, sure. It's the land of sunshine, stars, and swirling, sweeping spotlights. But there's a darker side to the entertainment mecca. An underside teeming with wandering, uprooted spirits and wild tales of paranormal activity. With Halloween just around the corner, Parade takes a spooktastic tour of some of the most hair-raising places and eerie events of haunted Hollywood. And it goes on to say, forget what you see crawling out of the dark shadows on the TV or movie screen. Tinseltown has its own disturbing legends of haunted places, cursed films, and long unsettled spirits. Here's our first one, a bad sign. The famous Hollywood sign in Griffith Park at the eastern edge of the Hollywood Hills is said to be haunted by the ghost of a struggling young actress, Peg Entwistle, who committed suicide by leaping to her death on the top of the H in 1932, just before the release of 13 Women, which marked her only film role. Nighttime visitors to Griffith Park sometimes say they see visions of a woman in 1930s-era clothing roaming the trails around the sign or plummeting from the top, only to vanish before reaching the ground. And then we go on to the house that inspired Ghostbusters. The former home of actor Dan Aykroyd on Woodrow Wilson Drive had also been home to a teenage Natalie Wood, singer Mama Cass Elliott, and former Beatle Ringo Starr. The house was not especially known for disturbances until the former Saturday Night Live star moved into it in the early 1980s. It didn't take Aykroyd long to conclude that the house was haunted. Something was turning on his Stairmaster, playing the piano, and slamming doors. Aykroyd says one night he even felt someone or something crawl into bed with him, and it wasn't his wife, actress Donna Dixon. He chalked it up to ghosts and believers, believes at least one of them was the spirit of the home's former occupant, Elliot, of the folk pop group The Mamas and the Papas, who died of heart failure in 1974 at the age of 32. Instead of being unsettled by the paranormal activity, Aykroyd, who later moved out and sold the house, was inspired by it. The supernatural vibes gave him the idea to co-write with Harold Ramis the famed hit 1984 movie comedy Ghostbusters. I'm sure it's Mama Cass, the actor said in a 2003 interview. What made him so certain? Some of the disturbances were so large and noisy, Aykroyd noted, you get the feeling it's a big ghost. Then we have the father figure. Ozzie Nelson portrayed the clean-cut All-American Dad in The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet on TV from 1952 through 1966. After Nelson's death at age 69 in 1975, the owners of his former home in the Hollywood Hills reported hearing footsteps and seeing a ghost wearing a cardigan sweater. Once a female visitor sleeping alone upstairs felt someone crawl into bed with her and began kissing her. Realizing it wasn't her husband, then rushing to turn on the light, she was relieved and shocked to discover there was no one there. The Adventures of Ozzie, indeed. Then we have the Haunted Hotel. The most modern ghost can be found at the Chateau Marmont, the all-star hotel located above the Sunset Strip. That's where it's said that the afterlife party never ends, with the spirits of former guests such as comedian John Belushi, Doors singer Jim Morrison, and Led Zeppelin drummer John Bonham still hanging around. Well, Belushi was 33 when he died of a drug overdose in a bungalow in 1982. Morrison and Bonham didn't expire at the Marmont, but they could have. Bonham once rode a motorcycle through the hotel hallways and lobby, and Morrison, out of his mind on drugs, nearly died when he fell from the roof of his bungalow after dangling from a gutter. Then there are the spooky cinemas. The specter of a tall, thin man, said to be the ghost of movie magnate Howard Hughes, is thought to roam the hallways of the Pantages, one of Hollywood's crown jewel theaters of its golden age. Hughes purchased the movie palace in 1949, and it hosted the Academy Awards from 1950 until 1960. The Vogue, built on the former site of an elementary school that burned to the ground in 1901, killing 25 children and a teacher, is where thousands of visitors have reported seeing strange apparitions during movie screenings, including a little girl skipping across the stage. And at the TCL Chinese Theater, formerly Groman's, then Mann's, audiences have often watched the screen's curtains violently shaking by themselves before a show, or have felt ice-cold blast or shoulder taps, believed to denote the presence of a former employee who hanged himself backstage. This ghost gets around. Hollywood's most active ghost would have to be that of Rudolph Valentino, the silent film legend, who died in 1926 at the age of 31 from periodontitis and surgery complications. Even though he was a bona fide superstar in his short lifetime, he became a legend after his untimely death, and it's estimated that far more people have seen his ghost than saw his movies. His spectral presence is one of the most commonly cited apparitions in Hollywood and has been reported in more than a dozen locations. Before they were demolished, both his former L.A. homes were common places for Valentino's ghost spotting. He continues to make appearances in the costume department of Paramount Pictures, which is across the street from Hollywood Forever Cemetery, where his body was laid to rest, in Los Angeles hotels, and further up the coast, where the Italian-born actor liked to go to relax. So lots of places to see that ghost. Then we have Fatal Attractions. These cursed movies were plagued by doom, disaster, and even death. Poltergeist, 1982. Star Jo Beth Williams recalls that paintings in her home would be crooked when she returned home each day from shooting the scare flick about a modern haunted house. Dominique Dunn, who played the family's oldest daughter, died shortly after the release of the film when her boyfriend strangled her. And Heather O'Rourke, who played the younger daughter, died in 1988 at age 12 of septic shock due to a misdiagnosed bowel obstruction. And then we have Rebel Without a Cause from 1955. All three stars of the teen angst classic, James Dean, Sal Mineo, and Natalie Wood, died tragic accidental deaths that led many to believe their appearances in the movie cursed their fates. Dean, 24 at the time, fatally crashed his Porsche Spyder into another car on U.S. Route 466 near Shalom, California, in 1955. Mineo was stabbed at age 37 during a robbery near his West Hollywood apartment in 1976. And at 43, Wood drowned under mysterious and suspicious circumstances in 1981 while on a boat trip with her husband, Robert Wagner, and actor friend, Christopher Walken. A. Tuck, the fish-out-of-water comedy about the Alaskan hunter's struggles to adapt to life in New York City, was so badly cursed that it never got made. All of the stars ever attached to it, John Belushi, Sam Kinison, John Candy, and Chris Farley, died from drug overdoses, a car crash, and a heart attack. And then we have The Crow from 1994. A series of disastrous events plagued the production of the action film, including the electrocution of a crew member, a hurricane, and the accidental shooting death of the star Brandon Lee, 28, when a real bullet mistakenly left in a prop gun was fired into his abdomen. Lee's untimely death was eerily similar to that of his father, martial arts film legend Bruce Lee, who also died while working on a movie at the age of 32. And then finally, the Magic Man. The master magician and escape artist Harry Houdini vowed to his wife Bess before he died on Halloween in 1926 that he would try to contact her from beyond the grave. That was apparently never successful, but strange things have been happening for decades near the Laurel Canyon site where the couple lived. A recording studio called The Mansion, owned by producer Rick Rubin, is on the property today, and various musicians have reported weird sights and odd occurrences. There are definitely ghosts in the house, said Red Hot Chili Peppers guitarist John Frusciante. But they're friendly. At times dating back to the 1970s, people have reported seeing an apparition of a man wandering the grounds. Could it be Houdini trying to fulfill his promise to Bess? And there you go. Some fascinating stuff there in Hollywood to start off our Halloween theme. Now on to another town with its own disturbing legend, as writer Jim Barnes takes us to West Virginia for a, quote, moving, respectful tour of the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. Now, his article appeared in the May 25th, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. If only these walls could talk, the thought occurs to me as I'm led down the long, gloomy corridors of the building known as the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which housed thousands of patients over its 130-year history as a hospital for people with mental illnesses and disabilities. But after hearing about the horrors that took place here, including patients who endured severe overcrowding, were shackled to walls, or were victims of abuse, I realized that perhaps it is better that the walls remain silent. The asylum stands on a lush 300-acre parcel of land in what is now Weston, West Virginia. The Virginia General Assembly authorized its construction in 1858, intending that it join its predecessors in Williamsburg and Staunton as the Commonwealth's third such institution. The outbreak of the Civil War brought a diversion of funds and a delay in construction. When the asylum admitted its first patients in 1864, it was under the governance of West Virginia, which was admitted to the Union the year before, having begun the process of becoming a separate state in 1861. The asylum housed patients until 1994, when it was replaced by William R. Sharp Jr. Hospital, also in Weston. The abandoned hospital remained shuttered for more than a decade and fell hard into a state of neglect and disrepair. West Virginia businessman Joe Jordan and his family purchased the former asylum at auction in 2007 with the intention of preserving and restoring it. The facility was open to the public later that year, sparking complaints about the use of pejorative term lunatic in the name and the controversial titles such as events as the Psychopath and Lobotomy Flashlight Tour. In news accounts at that time, mental health advocates criticized the facility for exploiting people with mental illness and denigrating the field of psychology. A spokeswoman for the asylum said last week, although the facility went by several names over the years, the name Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum was chosen simply because it was the facility's original name. The facility now offers a variety of tours and experiences, including paranormal tours, 45 and 90-minute heritage tours, photography tours, ghost hunts, and tours of the facility's farm, cemeteries, and wards for the criminally insane. The year-long calendar of events features such diverse affairs as a drag show, barbecue championship, car show, and haunted house, and annual asylum ball. Although the Psychopath and the Zombie Flashlight Tour have been discontinued, the asylum's calendar still includes special events with questionable names and themes such as Crazy for Barbecue, Zombie Paintball, and the Ghost Tour Spin Tales of Patients Who Lived and Died There. I arrived for my tour of the asylum, which is about a five-hour drive from the district, on a sunny but chilly day in early April, soon after the beginning of the spring tour season. I prefer my history straight up, no lost souls, disembodied voices, or self-propelled objects, so I opt for the 90-minute heritage tour, which covers all four floors of the main hospital building and the first floor of the medical center. While waiting for the tour to start, I watch a short film about the history of the asylum and browse through two front rooms that feature photos and displays commemorating the lives and works of Dorothea Dix and Thomas Story Kirkbride, 19th century advocates for treating mentally ill people with dignity. Dix was a social reformer whose tireless efforts led to the establishment of the nation's first public hospitals for people with mental illnesses and disabilities. Kirkbride, a physician, pioneered the construction of asylums designed to promote healing and recovery, emphasizing the restorative properties of natural sunlight and beautifully landscaped grounds. His ideas influenced the design and construction of hundreds of such facilities, including St. Elizabeth's Hospital in the district, as well as the asylum in Weston. And speaking of the district, that's Washington, D.C. she's referring to. At the appointed time, a small group gathers inside the hospital's main entrance, where we are greeted by Lothar, our guide, who is dressed in an old-style nurse's uniform. At the outset, she addresses the issue of the facility's name. Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum was the name given the hospital by Virginia General Assembly when it was established in 1858, she says. When West Virginia assumed control of the asylum in 1863, its name changed to the West Virginia Hospital for the Insane. By the early 1900s, it was known simply as Weston State Hospital, which Lothar acknowledges is more politically correct. As she leads us around the exterior of the main building, I'm reminded of a line from Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel, "Stroll around the grounds until you feel at home." The setting is beautiful, and the hospital's exterior is stunning. The facility is aptly described on its Facebook page as appearing more European castle than American hospital, with an imposing Gothic structure that exemplifies Victorian architecture at its finest. The building, designated as a National Historic Landmark in 1990, is indeed massively impressive. It spans nearly a quarter of a mile from end to end, 1,295 feet to be exact. Lothar informs us that the interior contains more than 9 acres of floor space, with several wings extending from the building's central area. It is, she says, the second largest hand-cut sandstone building in the world. The largest, by the way, is the Kremlin. Lothar points out the athletic fields on the front lawn, still equipped with a backstop where soldiers played baseball during the Civil War. Over the years, children from the town were allowed to play baseball and football there. To one side is a hill where 3 cemeteries serve as the final resting place for patients whose families never reclaimed their bodies, often because of the stigma associated with mental illness. Lothar says greenhouses and a dairy barn, were among the buildings that provided work for some of the patients. Whenever possible, they were given tasks that would give them a sense of accomplishment and reduce the need for paid staff, she says. When the tour moves inside, Lothar warns that it will be colder because we won't feel the sunshine anymore. She's right. The facility has only been partially restored, and the interior is cold in the winter and hot in the summer. The long, dark corridors are flanked by walls with badly peeling paint, and water pools on the floors of some of the rooms. The tour moves quickly through rooms that once served as the kitchen, dining areas, employee break room, morgue, and geriatric men's ward. We pass the dentist's office, barbershop, and beauty parlor. The old soldiers' ward once housed World War I veterans suffering from what was then known as shell shock, a term that has been replaced by post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Lothar shows us the apothecary, where heroin, cannabis, and bourbon were among the medicines that were dispensed to treat the patients. A cross is displayed in the window of a large empty auditorium, indicating the room was once used as a chapel. The auditorium served multiple purposes, such as an athletic court, where boys from the town would play basketball against teams of patients. The local high school even held its proms there, Lothar says. The upper floors include living areas for the patients, doctors, and nurses. We pass a room that has been featured on the television programs that focus on ghosts and the paranormal. Lothar says it's reputed to be one of the hospital's most haunted rooms, where she swears that she once saw a ball move by itself, a good teaser for one of the asylum's ghost tours. As Lothar leads us through the wings where the patients lived, it becomes apparent that the hospital is a study in contrast and contradictions. It was conceived and constructed with good intentions and high ideals, respect for the dignity of each individual, with bright, airy living spaces, nicely decorated common areas, high-quality food service, and an open campus, all of which were intended to promote healing and recovery. The hospital was originally designed as a residence for 250 patients. Most would have a tiny private room with a small bed and a window to let in natural daylight and provide a scenic view. But the grim reality fell far short of those lofty ambitions. Over time, the hospital became badly overcrowded, housing more than 2,600 patients at its peak occupancy in the 1950s, Lothar says. She tells us that the rooms and corridors were crammed with as many beds as they could hold. When the overcrowding was most severe, the same beds were used by multiple patients, sleeping in shifts. One wing displays photos depicting some of the most controversial treatments that were used over the years, an insulin shock therapy in which patients were placed in medically induced comas, ice-cold hydrotherapy to treat women diagnosed with hysteria, and ice-pick lobotomies. The notorious lobotomies, which doctors performed form for decades in the mid-20th century involved the insertion of an instrument resembling an ice pick through the patient's eye sockets to sever connections in their brains, usually destroying their personality as a result. The Weston facility was one where Walter Freeman, known as the father of the lobotomy, performed the controversial procedures, Lothar says. Before the tour ends, she stops to talk about why people were committed to the asylum. It wasn't always because of mental illness. They might have had physical ailments such as asthma, epilepsy, rabies, or tuberculosis. Some had suffered brain damage from being kicked by a horse. The asylum's gift shop displays a poster, an enlargement of a document compiled from patient case studies listing some of the factors that led patients to be admitted to the asylum between 1864 and 1889. It includes such curious entries as vicious vices in early life, seduction, egotism, bad whiskey, indigestion, loss of arm, shooting of daughter, and doubt about his mother's ancestors. All of those in quotes, by the way. In the 1800s, when women had few rights, it was easy for men to have their wives committed for the rest of their lives, she says, suggesting this could have been a way for the men to get their wives out of the way so they could pursue new relationships. This might explain some of the entries documenting some of the underlying reasons behind hospital admissions. Change of life, menstrual problems, and childbirth, as well as political or religious excitement, disappointed love, death of sons in war, domestic trouble, laziness, or novel reading. The tour provides a fascinating look at the asylum and a glimpse into the lives of the people who resided and worked there. Despite my misgivings about the use of the term lunatic in the facility's moniker and the names of some of the events, I feel that the Heritage Tour has generally been tastefully conducted and respectful of those who received care there. When the tour ends, I study the poster in the gift shop and wonder about the patients, what their lives had been like before they arrived there and the reasons they were institutionalized, as well as their experiences inside. The asylum does not have medical records of the patients who were admitted there, and I understand why their names or images are omitted from the tour, but the asylum story is ultimately about people, and although the tour has left me wanting to know more about them, their secrets will never see the light of day. And by the way, the writer Jim Barnes is based in Leesburg, Virginia, and he has a website, notesinletters.com, notesinletters.com. So if you want to find out more about some of these travels he's had. Well, speaking of traveling, we have Rachel Walker's article, In Santa Fe, Searching for a Ghost and Finding Enchantment. This one appeared in the September 14, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. Most visitors to Santa Fe, New Mexico, come to immerse themselves in the city's internationally renowned arts and culture. Others are drawn by the cuisine. Restaurants include James Beard Award winners and hole-in-the-wall taco stands, and the city's red and green chilies are renowned for their flavor. Still, more tourists come to experience the crisp cerulean skies and clean air as they navigate the surrounding Sangre de Cristo Mountains. There are also desert explorers and river rats whose kayaks and stand-up paddleboards dot the surrounding waterways, giving Santa Fe a recreational edge akin to Boise, Idaho, or Boulder, Colorado, minus the crowds. I traveled to Santa Fe in July, partly to look for a ghost. Specifically, I was hoping for a glimpse of Julia Staub, a German-Jewish bride brought from the old country by her husband Abraham in the late 19th century. Julia is believed to haunt the Las Posadas de Santa Fe Resort and Spa, a grand property off the city's main plaza where she and her family once lived. I discovered the Staubs in the pages of American Ghost, A Family's Haunted Past in the Desert Southwest, a 2015 memoir by my friend and district native, Hannah Nordhaus. Hannah, who was Julia's great-great-granddaughter, explored Julia's journey to the untamed western United States and mysterious death, reputed to be grim, likely violent, and possibly self-inflicted. Full disclosure, mine was not an original mission. Julia's spirit has beckoned ghost hunters to Santa Fe since the late 1970s, when she first reported to have made paranormal appearances showing up on the staircase in the hotel's main building and waking guests in her former bedroom. Her story intrigued me as much as the city itself, a place I hadn't visited since my childhood, but whose allure was exotic, historical destination loomed large in my imagination. La Posada was the ideal starting place. Situated on 6 acres, the resort consists of the Staub House, the original Victorian mansion Abraham built for Julia in 1882, now remodeled in the adobe style of the Southwest. Extensive artwork lines the walls and rooms in the Staub House, as well as part of the hotel's art program. Long before galleries dominated Santa Fe cultural scene, La Posada showcased the work of American artists. Today, it curates professional artwork through exhibitions and sales, earning it a reputation as the Art Hotel of Santa Fe. Guests stay in adobe casitas around the property, most built in the 1930s, to house visiting artists, and the entire resort has a secluded, peaceful ambiance. My family listened to American Ghost on the drive to Santa Fe, and upon arrival, I dragged my crew into the Staub House to admire the historical photos and to climb the grand staircase. My attempts to telegraph my presence to Julia were interrupted by my hungry, energetic sons, ages 6 and 8, and I made a quick reassessment. Despite my personal desire to delve into Julia's world, this trip would be punctuated with catering to their needs. Our four days became more of a reconnaissance mission to historical Santa Fe than a thorough exploration of it. After a quick lunch, we strolled through the old town of Santa Fe, passing the one-time location of the Staub Mercantile on the main plaza. We admired the turquoise and silver jewelry sold by Native Americans, many Hopi, Arapaho, and Navajo. The artisans gather under the portico of the Palace of Governors, and their wares are, for the most part, stunning. Some of the shops we explored were in centuries-old buildings, and we had to duck as we walked through the doorway so as not to hit our heads on the low, narrow entrances. At San Miguel Chapel, we believe to be the oldest in the United States, built sometime between 1610 and 1628, we paused to marvel at the thick adobe walls and the wooden altar screens at the front of the chapel. For lunch, we drove to the Tune-Up Cafe, a small diner situated in a residential neighborhood about a mile from central downtown. After ringing up our order of chili rellenos and enchiladas, the cashier gently informed me that many Santa Fe locals avoid the plaza because of all the tourists. She likened the atmosphere to a theme park. I considered her criticism as I savored the rich, cheesy food from the cafe's shaded patio. While true that kitschy gift shops and T-shirt stores exist downtown, they mix with quite the concentration of world-class art, some of it hanging at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum and the New Mexico Museum of Art. I don't doubt the locals experience tourist fatigue. The city reports 2 million visitors each year, but I disagree. There's so much to Santa Fe that we encountered only a fraction of its charm in our short trip. We indulged in not one but two delectable chocolaterias. We preferred Cacao Chocolate House for its drinkable chili chocolate elixir. Ooh. At the Railroad Yard Arts District, my sons explored an old rail car before sampling their first sopapillas, dipping the crisp, deep-fried puffy bread into honey at La Quilza, a casual restaurant with sumptuous red and green chili sauce. The farmer's market, which operates year-round in a dedicated enclosed building, offered such fresh produce, live music, slush lemonade, and the boys' pick, sweet cinnamon rolls from Cloud Cliff Bakery. Well, now, there were other trip highlights. A trail run on the city's Dale Ball Trail Network through the Pinyon Pines, afforded by my husband, and long views of the unique New Mexico landscape, a mosaic of yucca and cactus, juniper, and pinyon pines. I experienced my first Japanese shiatsu massage and private hot tub with my family and friends at the 10,000 Wave Spa, and emerged more relaxed than I'd been in a year. In the end, the only thing I did not do in Santa Fe that had been high on my list was commune with Julia Staub. She eluded me the entire time, which, according to her great-great-granddaughter, was no surprise. Ghost, it turns out, did not like to be summoned. No matter, the experience of visiting Santa Fe was so entranced me that I've already planned a return trip this fall. Julia's ghost may not have shown herself to me, but the spirit of her adopted home most certainly did, and I remained possessed. And by the way, our writer, Rachel Walker, actually resides in Boulder, Colorado, which is another fun place to travel. So there you go. Lots of Halloween themes for you today on Armchair Traveler. And that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it, that you'll be with us next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Any comments or questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.